Marketing Companion. Here are your hosts, Mark Schaefer and Tom Webster, sponsored by Voices Heard Media.
Hey, everybody, this is Mark Schaefer and my companion on the Marketing Companion, Tom Webster, and we've got a wonderful show for you today, a very interesting, relevant, timely, and scintillating show. But as we do once in a while here in the Marketing Companion, we are going to introduce a new concept because, you know, Tom and I, we walk the talk. We are always looking for new marketing adjacencies that we can bring to you and serve our valued audience. Now, one of the things we've been talking about is that we've noticed that there is really very little dissent on the web, like there used to be. Everybody just seems to be so nice to each other because they don't want to rock the boat. And we believe strongly that to grow as an industry, to grow as marketers and as individuals, we need more thoughtful criticism of the content, the ideas, the strategies, even the individuals driving our business. So today I'm proud to announce our newest Mark and Tom Enterprise, Prick Starter, the platform to use when you're tired of social media nicey. You really need to try this. Log in to Prick Starter for the best in social media criticism and commentary. For example, here is the latest rant from one of our beta testers, Sean Connery.
Well, Miss Moneypenny, I'm sick of the social business malarkey. That's all crap.
And how about this one from Prickstarter community member Christian Bale?
Pinterest has been taken over by robots.
And William F. Buckley literally came back from the dead to lead this dialogue on social media gurus.
It's not a sign of arrogance for the king to rule, Lovey. That's what he's there for.
So there you have it. Ladies and gentlemen, Prickstarter. When the BS is getting thick, come be a prick. I'm excited.
Wow. Yeah, you know, that didn't sound like William F. Buckley. That sounded like Jim Backus.
It did. It was a Gilligan's Island moment, and I was loving it.
It was a Gilligan's Island. It was Gilligan's Island William F. Buckley.
You can never get too much of Gilligan's Island in general. Were you a Ginger or a Marianne kind of guy?
I was Marianne all the way.
Me too. Marianne all the way. Yeah. All right. Let's get going here. So the topic we're going to cover is something that kind of exploded on the web this week. And this is something new. I was actually the ignition point. Usually I don't seek that kind of thing out. But as fate would have it, I wrote a blog post called Content Shock. And so let me just, I don't want to, you know, beat a dead horse on this, but we do have some new things to talk about, some new ideas on this. So let me just start with the basic premise behind the post. And my observation is that most places I go, the mantra among marketers is the same. It's like, cover the world with content. More blog posts, more podcasts, more Pinterest, whatever. And I don't see that there's much dialogue about some of the implications of what this is going to lead to, and that we need to start thinking about what's going to be next, because there's always a next. And I think there's going to be a first mover advantage for those who can figure out what is next and get on board. And that dialogue just isn't there when you read the literature on the social web. Even look when the books that are out today, it's all still beating the content drum. Now, this is what has me concerned. I was looking at some research, and the amount of time that people spent consuming content in 1980 was about 4 hours a day. In the year 2000, it was about 7 hours a day. So one of the big enablers there was the internet. Today, it's nearly 10 hours a day. And as we've discussed on this podcast before, our content consumption, at least here in America, has been greatly enabled by mobile devices. Now, so on average, an American is consuming content 10 hours a day. What's the limit? Where is it going to go? Maybe you can imagine 12. Maybe you can imagine 13. But there's a limit. And at the same time, the amount of content is exploding. So it's going to become more and more difficult to cut through the noise, cut through the clutter, and become the signal. And what I'm seeing in my own personal experience with some of my clients is that this is already happening. The economics of content marketing are changing. It was easy when we were publishers and it was something novel. There was a lot of demand for content. There wasn't that much around, so you could start a blog and get an audience. But month by month, that is becoming more difficult. That is becoming more costly, and I think that is going to rapidly escalate in the next year, let's say.
Well, I think you're onto something. You know, this is certainly a conversation you and I have had in the past. It's something you know, I've written a couple of things on my blog about what happens when content marketing stops working. I mean, one of the things I think we're living in now for a lot of people, we're living still in the age of, you know, A1 limousine content marketing. And, you know, back when the yellow pages were the way that people looked up businesses, and the first limo company figured out that if they changed their name to A1 limousine, they would be the first one people saw and they would get the calls, right? And then you got A1 limousine and A1 limousine and A1 limousine. You got all those limousine companies. We're still in that age for content marketing.
Yeah,
marketing where you can, right. Well, let's look at my search logs. Oh, people are asking questions about this.
Right.
I'm going to use those keywords and answer that question.
Right.
Well, that's fine.
Right.
But that stops working up to a point when all your competitors do the same things, right? When all of the players achieve the same level, then you've got to find another way. And that's the point that I took from your article, not that content marketing is going to stop working, mm-hmm. but that when, you know, 80% of the players at the table are all fairly equally skilled, then you've got to find the next thing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just going to stop working.
Right. And I think that's what we need to be thinking about. Let me give you just a small example. And again, I'm a small business. I think I'm typical in this space. In some ways, I have an advantage because I've been developing content in a very serious way since 2009. And many businesses are just now starting to get into this. But there was one comment on the blog from a fellow named Ken Rosen. Now, Ken had been a fan of my blog for years. And Ken, I hadn't heard from the man in a long time. He came onto the blog post and left a comment. And he said, "I am living proof of what you're saying. Mark, I do have an emotional connection to you. You and I kind of started together on the web. I love your content. Your content is better than ever. But I just don't have time anymore. There's so many other distractions. There's so much other content out there. I've got to draw the line." And so we actually had a really cool dialogue in the comment section about what does that mean? What does that take? So even in this little micro example of my own small business, here is someone that was a loyal fan that did have a connection to me. What am I going to do? What's next? Because the content marketing is not working. And if, you know, a lot of people in the post said, "Well, you've got to be better." This is like the Be Amazing camp, right? You got to be better. Well, I got to tell you something. I'm working my ass off. I'm doing the best I possibly can. And to show you how personally this is impacting me and my business, let's say Mark Schaefer, Schaefer Marketing Solutions, 2 years ago compared to now. 2 years ago, I didn't have paid writers. I've got paid writers because I want more diversity on the blog. I want different kinds of content on the blog. I didn't have paid cartoonists. For the last 2 years, I've had paid cartoonists on the blog. Now I've hired a part-time designer to help me with different kinds of content, like slideshare presentations. And I didn't have that 2 years ago. So the cost of producing content, not just the cost associated with my time, but this is real dollars out the door, are going up, 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 up. And yet I'm losing Ken Rosen. I know I'm losing others. And so I'm challenging myself to think, what's next? What do I need to do to fight through this and not just get new customers, but keep the ones I've got? And I'm passionate about this because I think businesses just can't listen to the gurus out there and say, everything's going to be okay. Cover the world with content. I just think those days are over. It's going to vary by business. In some businesses, there's an ether in the market. People, your competitors are asleep. So in those circumstances, hey, live it up. Enjoy it while you can. But if those people wake up and they've got a lot of money, then you're going to start a content arms race that's not sustainable long term.
Well, again, I think a lot of content works now, simply again, because of kind of gamesmanship and arbitrage, and you're gaming the system and you're doing well. And maybe that fools you into thinking that you've got great content. Maybe you do in fact have great content, but there's two ways to look at this. Way number one, I remember a long time ago, I saw a speech by Microsoft's head of product for Internet Explorer, a guy named Dean Hakimovich. And he talked about how there were three phases of the web. The first phase was browse. Mm-hmm. We first got our browsers and we didn't know what to do. And so we just browsed. Then the second phase was search. Alta Vista started to work a little better. There was even this fledgling little startup out of Palo Alto called Google. We started to be able to find the information that we wanted. And then his point back then was the third phase was subscribe. Soon we will subscribe to the things we want and have them brought to us. Mm-hmm. My own behavior on the web has changed dramatically in the past 2 years. My travel has increased significantly over the past 2 years. I no longer have or read an RSS reader. And that used to be like a morning ritual for me. I do not have an RSS reader at all. So that content, it doesn't even matter what it is. Just that entire channel has not made the cut in my life. And I think, on the technology side, I think there's a move to create this sort of fourth phase of the internet, which would be, the age of the great algorithm, where things are suggested to you, where some algorithm learns your preference and suggests things to you. In other words, we're trying to solve a problem, quote unquote, with some technology.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure it's a consumer problem.
Shel Holtz, a fellow I admire quite a bit, wrote a dissenting opinion to my post, which, I wrote a post back to say, hey, Shel, you're not really dissenting. We really kind of agree. But one of the points he made is exactly what you're saying, Tom, is that he thinks that these algorithms and filters will improve that will actually boost the ability to consume content. I think it will improve the ability to consume content, but at the end of the day, if you're an extraordinary person that's consuming content 10 hours a day, that's a lot. I'm not sure having a filter is going to increase the number of hours. It may change what you consume in those 10 hours, which is what Chris Penn also mentioned in a post. He said, look, you've got the same hours. The hours are not going to change, but the challenge is, how are you going to fill those hours? You've got more choices, and the quality is going to be increasing, or at least it should be increasing under these competitive pressures.
Yeah, but we've always had this problem. We've had this problem for years and years and years. We had this problem when we got cable. Mm-hmm. So, needing these algorithms, that's something that marketers need, maybe. I think the average consumer you talk to is not weeping and gnashing their teeth about an inability to consume as much content as they would like. There's still X amount of media being consumed. That's not going to change. But, the word I use here is media. And I think there's a tendency, content marketers love to make distinctions between owned media and paid media and earned media. And, you know, owned media is what, you know, what the brand has that it can control, and paid media is what they buy in advertising. But earned, you earn it, man. That's quality. You earned your place in front of people's eyeballs. Well, here's what a consumer calls all three of those: media.
Yeah.
Consumers don't make those distinctions, and it's a value judgment, and I think a flawed one, to cast aspersions upon paid and owned because they're not quote unquote earned. And let me give you an example of that. In the last week of November, my company fielded a study, which we haven't released yet, although we've released one tidbit of it, about the most popular artists for country music fans and fans of who are especially young, 12 to 34. The number one country artist by far, with like 82% approval rating, was the stat we came out with, was Carrie Underwood. A week later, The Sound of Music Live comes out to, you know, the highest ratings since I don't even know what. It pulled almost a 6 share when you fold DVR ratings into it. That's 6% of all TVs that could watch it were turned to it, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. 22 million viewers when you fold all that in. Mm-hmm. Right now, we do research a week before that says Carrie Underwood is by far the number one artist for country music artist, right?
Yeah.
Don't you think NBC knows that? Do you think NBC blindly chose Carrie Underwood?
They did the work.
They did the work. They did the same sort of thing we did before we even thought of it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, okay, they paid a lot to promote it. Yes, they own it. It's their network. But don't you think they earned it? Don't you think they did the work to deliver something that a vast majority of people would want to see? And that's, you know, and again, when we make these fine lines between owned, earned, and paid, maybe that makes, you know, that validates PR people, that validates marketing people, that validates advertising people. But at the end of the day, the consumer is in complete control. Those distinctions don't mean much. And if you don't earn it, whether it's owned or paid or whatever, by understanding what your audience, the basic needs, wants, and desires of an audience, then you're not going to be in front of anyone. And that's really what this is all about, is working harder.
I think it's really, you've created a very rich comment there. We could talk about so many of the points that you made, but two important ones for me are, number one is doing the work, and another nuance I'll add to that, Tom, is that I don't know, but I would bet that Carrie Underwood also has an audience that engages on social media. So by inserting her into this, you know, let's face it, that was a huge bet by the network, huge risk. But inserting her into this, they also had the other potential opportunity, not just to have the own media, but to have the earned media through the social media conversations that would take place. The other comment that you made that I thought is so good is this idea that there's no distinction among the consumer. So some of the comments to the content shock blog were along the lines of, look, if I own my niche, all right, if I really work my niche and I'm providing great content in my niche, I'm going to be okay. To some extent, that's true. But we also have to keep in mind, as you eloquently stated, that consumers are consuming. And in fact, to some extent, you are competing with the X Games on Red Bull. To some extent, you are competing with The Sound of Music on the network television station. To some extent, you are competing with Pandora or Spotify. These are all content consumption options and that people are making choices about every day. So make no mistake, even if you're creating great content, that doesn't mean people are going to be spending the same time with you that they are today. If somehow you're not keeping up, upping your game, or finding a new way to compete.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we've had content marketing and native advertising for quite a while. If you've ever flown an airplane and read the airline magazine, you've seen native advertising, right. You know, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's Birmingham, City of Industry. You know, if that content's compelling, you're going to read it. And if it isn't compelling, you're not going to read it. But I will tell you this, the people that do those airline magazines, and I actually know someone who does this exact work, do a lot of research into their audience. An audience is not the same thing as a buyer or customer, right? An audience is anyone who might possibly come into contact with your content. They're not part of your funnel. They're not in a purchase cycle with you. I mean, this is so obvious, right? Now, I've seen a lot of content strategy work and content planning. And I guess I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant here. I talked about this at New Media Expo last week.
Oh, do, Tom. Oh, do.
All right, I will. I talked about this at New Media Expo last week about how content strategy typically starts, right? Step one in content strategy is personas. You construct personas of people relating to various aspects of your buying cycle, right? If you're an IT company, we have Outsource Oliver and, Activist Amy and, whatever.
Yeah.
Spend the most, Dan. Okay. Well, these
Microsoft
are fakey town people. Microsoft Matt. Right. These are fakey town people. Right? There's no such thing as these people. I actually read one of these personas, and it lists all these bullet points about wants a global partner. But no, he doesn't want a global partner. That's not what he wants at all. You know, that's maybe in his job description, but that is not what Outsource Oliver wants. Yeah. Let me guarantee you. Mm-hmm. So these airline magazines and other media properties like NBC, like Grantland, one of my favorite sites on the web, they do a lot of audience research, the type of research that tells you what the people who could read your content, what their basic values, attitudes, and beliefs and desires are, and not how they're going to interact with your product, not answering FAQ questions, which is the first step, don't get me wrong, but it's not going to win my attention in the long run if I'm part of your audience. And we all have audiences, Mark, right? I mean, I could do personas based upon customers or, people who have put inquiries into my website. Guess what? That's less than 1% of the people who read my website, mm-hmm. right? I mean, my blog is read by 99.9 times more people who have nothing to do with any aspect of being in my purchase funnel, right? Mm-hmm. So, making personas for my blog is not a good idea. First of all, they're like fakey people.
Yeah.
And second of all, it would really only impact about 1% of the people who read it.
This is an interesting topic, and this is kind of a controversial, I think, point that I might make here, is that I know in a lot of these content marketing plans, the number one step is to create these personas. And my advice a lot of these times, Tom, is to not do it at all. And mm-hmm. here's why. A while back, I had an opportunity to interview this fellow, Dr. Robert Cialdini. I mean, a great academic, great intellect. He wrote this book, Influence at Work. And I said, Dr. Cialdini, in this information-dense world, how do you stand out? Which is really relevant to this content shock topic. And he said, be more human. Now, it's kind of easy, it's somewhat easy for me and you to be human because more or less we are our brands. But when you get into a big company environment, trying to succeed in this content marketing space, and you've got tag team bloggers or video producers or podcasters who are trying to aim their content at these personas, how can that be human? How can that be real? How can that be even interesting, I might suggest?
Yeah.
So I really believe that Dr. Cialdini is onto something here. And I think that not only do we need to be more human, I think we need to be radically human. I think we need to be radically honest and open with people. And that is going, if we have a hope to hold on to this audience, to hold on to this mind share with these people, we've got to create this loyalty. We've got to create this trust through these emotional connections. And people, they do have this desire, not just to hear from us, not just to buy from us, but to know us, to have this. It's a communion between a person and another person, yes, but it's also a communion between another person and a brand, or another person and a company. We form the same emotional ties, and so I think this idea to stand out is going to be based on being human. And I don't know if writing or producing content toward personas is consistent with that.
I don't either, and I'll give you a really good example of this. You know, first of all, I think the organizing principle of your brand and the organizing principle really of your content or whatever we're talking about is never a what. It's never a noun. It's never your product. It's always a why. And so much of content strategy never starts with the why. You know, why do people buy or not buy from you? And I'll give you an example. So again, it's an example that I gave in my NMX talk last week. Let's say that you were with a toy company and you wanted to engage in a content marketing plan, some kind of content strategy for a doll or action figure. When, let's say if you follow the received wisdom of content strategy, you start with some personas, all right? So we have moms and we have dads and we have, you know, 9-year-olds with disposable income. Maybe we break those into boys and girls, and then we have collectors. So the organizing principle for all of those is the same thing. It's your product, right? That's convergent thinking. But what an audience strategy does, what media strategists do, the people who will be claiming more eyeball time, are the people who use divergent thinking. Because what actually unites these people is not your product or even the buying cycle, right? And if you look at, let's say that product is My Little Pony, there's three classes of people that buy My Little Pony. There's 8-year-old girls, there's 25-year-old cosplay enthusiasts, and there's men who call themselves bronies who love My Little Pony. Right. There's this whole like cult thing called the Brony.
You know, I just heard about that for the first time. I thought it was a joke.
It is not. No, it's not a joke. Right. It's a community. It's a community of people that has absolutely nothing in common with 8-year-old girls.
You're saying this is grown men?
This is grown men. They're called bronies.
And they collect and play with My Little Pony.
Yeah, they form a community around them. They're,
well, I'm feeling quite closeted and naive right now.
Well, I'm sure that there are two groups of bronies. There are the people who actively celebrate My Little Pony, and then there are the ironic bronies. But be that as it may, there are bronies. And if you looked at your personas and you looked at your purchase cycle and your buying habits or whatever, you'd never know that. You would have to do some audience research to figure this out. Because these clusters of people, they're divergent. They have nothing in common. I will tell you mathematically, if you take any three divergent, homogenous clusters of people, like 8-year-old girls, cosplay enthusiasts, and bronies, any three, they all have only one thing in common. That's Celine Dion. Now, what this means is, well, it's the lowest common denominator. If you're trying to please all of these actual homogenous clusters of people as opposed to personas, you're going to end up with mediocre content, right? You're not going to end up with anything that's passionate for any one group or another. Mm. So, you know, an audience strategy has to take some risks. It has to produce content that's going to be passionate for these divergent groups. So when you're trying to construct personas, you're leaving all of that out. You're trying to build around what, and you should be building around why. Why do these grown men buy My Little Ponies? Why do 8-year-old girls buy My Little Ponies? My guess is that the 8-year-old girl identifies much more with the values of the toy than the toy itself. Mm-hmm. And the toy is probably more important to the grown men.
I really don't want to know that. I don't want to. If you have the answer, I don't even want to see the research, Tom.
I just wanted to get bronies into this, and next week we can talk about.
Yeah.
Next week we'll talk about Mark and Tom's brain bleach.
Yeah, I need some right now. Bleach the brony images. Gosh, you know. I don't know.
Just getting back to your point, though, those are humans. And your buying cycle and your purchase cycle and a content strategy based around persona does not grapple with why these humans act the way they do. And it isn't about the product. It's about something else. That's what a media strategy does. That's what an audience strategy does. And that's the work that content marketers are going to either have to do themselves or tap into with other aspects of their company to start producing passionate content, not functional content. And I'll end this rant with this. We are still in the era where it is important to have useful and helpful content, right? Mm-hmm. Helpful is not a differentiator. Mm-hmm. There's no possible way to use your great question or your great standard, only we. There is no way to answer that question. Only we are helpful. It's not a differentiator. You got to do the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that next thing, that's going to be a big topic, not just for us, but for everyone, because I think we started to dance around today, Tom, some of these ideas about what's next. Where do we need to focus? Where do we need to stand out? But it's a really ripe topic, a ripe issue for us, and I'm sure we'll revisit it again in the future.
Well, no doubt. And I think as we explore more and more ways to find how to engage communities, how to make those communities more passionate, it's important to have tools for the job. And we want to thank our sponsor, Voices Heard Media, which has some great tools for engagement. I know they're doing a lot of work with social gaming and contesting and other ways to engage communities. So be sure and check them out. And this has been a super topic, Mark. Thanks for revisiting it. I know you've written some blog posts already on it, but I think it's a keeper.
Well, I think so too, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more dialogue. And hey, everyone, we'd love to hear from you. We appreciate every single one of you. We know that listening to this podcast is part of your content shock too. And so hang in there with us. We're going to do our best to bring you great value every single episode. And until next time, Mark Schaefer, Tom Webster, thanks for listening.